Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by Warren Sharp. You can follow him on Twitter at Sharp Football. Warren is one of the smartest football minds I have ever met, a very good football gambler, and of course, he always produces the Sharp Football Guide. You can also subscribe to his content on sharpfootballanalysis.com. Warren and I discussed the 2020 NFL season, a bunch of the results and findings from his book, looked at some of the futures bets we liked in 2020, and of course, discussed the coronavirus impact on what we expect to see for the 2020 NFL season. You know, I think Warren is a really sharp guy who has a lot of intelligent things to say about the league, so I definitely tried to do more listening than talking in this episode. I know some of you guys will really enjoy that, so let's go ahead and get into the episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can always leave a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts, and get bonus episodes of the show on patreon.com/takecast. And now let's get to Warren. All right, everyone, welcoming in Warren Sharp, the owner of sharpfootball.com, the author of the Sharp Football Guide that's really very, very pervasive on Twitter. Everyone reading, everyone posting their book when they get it. But Warren, we got to start with bad news today. Multiple MLB games are canceled now due to positive COVID tests. And of course, you and I are thinking, how does this impact the NFL? And I was just talking with Joe Bryant on Twitter, the owner of Football Guys, who seems to be more positive than you and I. I got to admit, I do not feel very positive about this situation as it pertains to football.
Well, first of all, Davis, happy to join you. I'm not happy about this situation. It was more or less inevitable that something like this was going to happen. It sucks that it happened so early. It really gets me to the point of feeling annoyed by the selfishness on so many levels. I mean, when you read about the story here, where three, I think, the players tested positive, and then they held a meeting that morning as a team and said, well, should we play this game or not, knowing that, you know, some of our guys had it, and they were like, let's play through it. Let's just deal with it. We're not going to stop. We want to just play. And it's not about what you want to do. It's about what's right to do. And I feel like the same is true for a lot of people in this country, and why we're still having a big problem like we are. It's not about what you want to do. It's about what's right to do. And look, I think the NFL, this is just my opinion projecting here, unless multiple teams during training camp come down with massive issues, they're not going to delay the start of week one. Now, would doing so be intelligent if they're going to put in place proper protocols to help us have the full 16-game season, as you alluded to pre-show? Yes, that would be smart. But I don't think that they're thinking along those lines. I think they're thinking of, well, let's just start the season. We're not going to delay the start of the season. But I think that there should be other protocols that they could put in place that still might allow us to start the season on time, but would actually keep these players safer. And I just don't know how seriously everybody's taking things here.
I think we've already started to see players be more concerned than the leadership is. We have the Chiefs right guard. Duvarney Tardif. Not going to try and get the full name out, but he opted out. He is actually a medical doctor, which, by the way, what an amazing person to be smart enough to be a medical doctor and good enough and strong enough to be a Super Bowl champion offensive lineman. So he opted out, and we started to see on Twitter, actually right before you and I got on air, Eric Ebron tweeted out something to the effect of like, this absolutely sucks. And we have started to basically get some inklings that NFL players are not super excited about reporting to an unprotocoled training camp. I think, Warren, the NFL's got to be seriously looking at their options for bubbling stuff up, right? Bubbling training camp, bubbling the season, you know, finding a hub city, whether that be, you know, paying the University of Wyoming to just take over the city and use their field. Like, there's got to be a way, because it seems like the problem for baseball is they expected these rather large organizations to travel all around the country. And then when you do the math, for football, we're talking, you know, twice the roster size. Then we're talking all the coaches. Then we're talking trainers. We're talking doctors. You know, I was doing a show with Pat Mayo last week, and our rough estimate of the amount of people to get one NFL game played, no fans, right? No concession workers or anything, was about 400 people. And that just does not really seem conducive to a season that's not going to take place in a bubble.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to see them operate in a bubble and make plans to do so far earlier. But clearly, you know, I don't think that that's in the cards. I really don't. Thinking realistically here. Now, thinking what I would prefer, yes. Thinking realistically as to what the NFL is planning on and like, okay, what's the backup plan? I don't think the backup plan is a bubble, because otherwise that would have been the preferred method. Like, I think we would have been gearing everything towards that already.
Yeah, that would have been plan A.
Plan A would have been in the bubble, because that's the safest thing. Absolutely, no doubt about it. It's the most logical thing to do. But I don't think our backup plan to this, oh, great, the Marlins are dealing with this now, so we're going to move everything to the bubble. I don't think that's in the cards here. So what could be in the cards, however, is every single, and I think it starts with the coach, but it's the leadership of that team. But then it obviously trickles down to the players, is how serious do you want to take this thing so that we don't have to forfeit any games this year? How serious are you guys prepared to, obviously it's going to help you out the most, not getting COVID. Nobody wants to get COVID, right? So how are we going to prevent that from happening? Well, the only logical thing that I can think of is you build practice facilities that are bubbled up at your stadium in the location where you can do so near your team facilities. And that's where these guys are camping out and staying. If you can't rent out a hotel nearby, that's what you guys are doing. You are traveling back and forth to your home. And if you need to, like, I don't know what the regulations would be on that, but you're instructing your family, we are going to stay in a bubble. Like, you guys can't be doing other things. And I know that to some people might suck, but I'm going to be real clear and honest. Like, I have not left my house probably more than 6 times since this whole thing happened, since March. My first thing that I canceled was a trip to speak at Sloan MIT. And since that point in time, I probably left my house 6 times. Now, my wife has gone and made a few more grocery runs than I have. We've also ordered in groceries. Granted, I do have a child who's high risk on some chemo meds, so that's a little bit a different situation. But that's how seriously I am trying to take things to ensure that my family is safe and that I'm not transmitting it to my parents or anything like that if I did come in contact with it by any chance. So, like, it's not impossible to do this. And if you're making millions of dollars to play football and your career could be impacted long-term by catching COVID, potentially, I don't know exactly what the percentage is. We don't even need to discuss that. We can simply say, potentially your career could be impacted, then it's in your best interest not to contract this. Do whatever you have to. Stop running around town doing other things. Live your life as conservatively as possible. It's 5 months. It's literally 5 months. Everyone can do this to some extent. And fortunately, the guys that we're asking to do this do have the money to be able to do what they need to on the home front to help ensure that people are adequately taken care of so that they can play football if they really want to. And I think the key thing that we've seen is one player making a poor decision could impact his entire team. And so that's massive. And I did see, I think it was Gilmore had some interesting words where he was talking about seeing other people tweeting out videos of them practicing and seeing them practicing in large groups of people, or seeing them in one city one day, in another city another day, in another city a third day. And he's like, what are these players thinking doing this? Because this could massively impact a team. And he's 100% right on that. So I think it can work even without bubbling the whole thing, but the players and the teams themselves have to bubble themselves in some capacity. And it starts with the coaches and the ownership figuring out the right plan. And then the players getting on board and realizing this is the only way we're going to have a season. And it's also the safest for me and my health and my family's health, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I've not been to a restaurant. I don't go to the gym all around me. So I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and things are back open, right? People around me have decided that life is gone back to normal. And certainly, I've not been a part of that at all. But I think what we've seen in the States is it just doesn't really work when you have like a 50% lockdown, right? Because what you get with a 50% lockdown is sure, you're going to minimize the cases some, but you know, we've seen in Texas, we've seen in Florida, we've seen in Arizona that even with a 50% lockdown, the hospitals still get pretty overwhelmed. And what you really need is you need like a 90% lockdown, right? You need essential workers, you need grocery stores, you need hospitals. And that it's not even come close to happening in the States. Whereas, you know, when in New Zealand, right, they have their rugby league is playing with fans in the stands. They finished an entire soccer season in Italy, in Spain, in England, and they were able, and in Germany, and they were able to do it with, in all those leagues, there were, I believe I read this morning, 20 positive cases total, including players, staff, you know, anyone involved in the stadium. And we just, for whatever reason, for a lot of very complex political and socioeconomic reasons, we just are not close here at all.
Yeah, it does make it more frustrating seeing those other countries at the levels that they're at. And I think for us, we are so involved in sports that one of the first things that we turn to is like, well, what are their sports doing? You know, it's only natural for us to look at their sports leagues first, almost. And of course, I was tracking everything with this really closely, and we saw how other countries were doing. And it just sucks that our country as a whole had such a head start, and then the NFL had such a head start. So I still think that, again, I believe unless multiple teams have something massive that occurs at training camp, which is a possibility, but still preventable, in my opinion, with the right actions being taken. And trust me, I mean, I've heard there's guys that are wearing bands on their hands at the team facilities. They're supposed to stay, it beats if you're within six feet of another band. Like, that doesn't help you when you're out on the practice field, of course, but they are doing a lot of things behind the scenes that aren't being publicized as much to try to keep people safe. But the issue becomes not necessarily at the facilities. It's just kind of like at the hospitals. My daughter has had to go to the hospital multiple times during this. I've had other family members with other kids that have health issues that have been in the hospital. The hospitals, like, when if you're not in like the emergency room or the COVID wing, like, they actually, from my own personal experience, I can't speak everywhere, do a really good job of protecting you. So it's like, I think these facilities, the players might be well protected in the facility itself. It's just like going home and doing things outside the facility and then coming back and interacting with the teammates. That's where I think the biggest concern lies. But we'll see. I mean, you and I don't know 100% of where things are. I try to be as optimistic of a person as possible, but also realistic at the same point in time, and try to do what I can to keep my own family safe. And I hope that the players in the NFL and all sports, of course, but NFL particularly, are doing what they can to keep themselves and their families safe to ensure their long-term status as professional athletes and take it super seriously. They don't have many years of being professional athletes. Try the best they can to stay safe and hope that the teams and the league are doing the right things to ensure that they're going to be as safe as possible with the return to the NFL. And we'll see this week, everybody starts to come back, and it'll be really interesting following the news cycles here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the most likely scenario is that we get some sort of season. Now, do I think the most likely scenario is 16 games plus full playoffs? You know, I'm not sure. There are so many questions to be answered. I am not as much in the know as a lot of other people, but, you know, the NFL, they have had a lot of time. I mean, they still have, you know, if things get pushed back a couple weeks, it's not a disaster. They still have time to figure things out. There is not going to be any shortage of replacement players, right? Like there are whole groups of guys who would be willing to sign up for practice squads and things like that. There are a lot of potential solutions. So I continue to be optimistic about some form of football happening, about things getting figured out. Just today is not the most optimistic day for team sports in the United States. But so with that in mind, I think that we should go ahead and start talking about what we expect to see on the field in 2020. Are you, we ready to do that?
Yeah, we are. And I will say just one last point on that. I think you're absolutely right. I do think we start, you know, my forecast, just total conjecture, we start week one. The issue becomes what happens if team comes down with it and can't play. Like there's too many people, too many issues with replacement players. Like it's just too widespread. And in that case, like I really think that the optimal solution is just suspend things for a couple of weeks. Like don't cancel everything, just suspend it. And I hope that we just have a reasonable outlook on what we're doing in terms of when the season ends, because I don't think you need to say, well, if we can't play the Super Bowl on this exact date, then the season's over and you know, we're not going to be able to do it. You've got to figure out a way around these flare-ups during the course of the season and what needs to happen. And I don't know the right answers, but yeah, I'm certainly ready to break down what we think we're going to see out there on the field for sure.
So the first thing I want to get into is when you were building out the guide for 2020, doing, you know, loads of statistical research, personnel research, you know, was there one nugget, one statistical inference that was the most surprising to you when you were creating it? Like, oh, I didn't expect this play type to be this successful, or I didn't expect this personnel grouping to be this great.
Well, I think if we stick with personnel grouping, like one of the bigger takeaways of the 2018 season, when we saw the Rams make the run to the Super Bowl, and obviously they could have won that game against the Patriots, but they did not, in a close, low scoring, relatively boring game, was their usage of 11 personnel, right? Oh my God, the Rams like cranked up their usage of 11. They're so unstoppable. Is this going to be a wave? Because we saw prior years, you know, around 60%. 11 personnel being used, and there was this seeming trend that we were going to start heading into more 11 personnel, and we were going to be spreading the field with all these wide receivers, and that really actually completely reversed course last season. Not only did the Rams reverse course and use a lot more 12 personnel, they upped their 12 personnel usage from 7% all the way up to 21% last season. But the league in general went all the way back to what it was in prior years, like 2016 and 2017, which was all the way down at like a 59% to 60% usage rate of 11 personnel. And it wasn't just the Rams doing it. There were a lot of teams doing it. And one of the things that stands out to me is just the efficiencies that were gained. But one of the things that we saw is like only 7 teams shifted to more 11 personnel in 2019 than they did in 2018, only 7. But we saw 21 teams shift to more 12 personnel, which is 2 tight ends out on the field. 21 teams used more 12 in 2019 than they did the prior year. And 13 teams actually used more 21 personnel, which is 2 running backs, typically a fullback. And so 2 running backs and 1 tight end. 13 teams shifted to more 21 personnel. Bottom line with all these numbers that we're throwing out here is that the league shifted more towards heavier groupings last season than they had in the prior year. And we were seeing a ton of efficiency out of that. We actually saw, you know, and I had a little Twitter thread on this the other day, but we actually saw the number one most EPA per play, the number one most yards per play, the number one highest success rate, all come out of 21 personnel, which is a fullback out on the field. And when you look at the 6 teams that used the most 21 personnel, the 49ers, the Vikings, the Ravens, the Broncos, the Patriots, and the Saints, 5 of those 6 teams made the playoffs. One of those 6 teams had the best record in football. That was the Baltimore Ravens. Another one of those teams, the 49ers, made the Super Bowl. So I think from a personnel grouping standpoint, I don't know that it surprised me, but it definitely would be a surprise to a lot of the people that, you know, didn't really pay as close of attention to that during the course of the season, but now are sitting back and they're contemplating, yeah, I do remember thinking, you know, all the talking heads on TV in 2018 towards the end were talking about how the Rams are crushing it with these three wides and we might see more of that from teams this next year. But the reality was we didn't see more of it. We saw much less of it across the board, and the efficiency was improved. To me, that talks to the ability to be unpredictable out of some of these heavier groupings. If you're spread out the field, it actually creates a lot of opportunity to have an efficient rushing attack. And we saw that with the Arizona Cardinals last year. You know, some of the things that they were doing offensively, it wasn't their great offensive line helping them run block, but it was the way that they were scheming up things using personnel helped gain some rushing efficiency. But we're also seeing that it's a lot easier to pass the ball when you have some heavier personnel on the field. Either they are helping with pass pro or they're making it look like runs. So the defense crowds the box and thinks it's run, and then you're throwing off of that. And it's just about keeping that defense guessing a little bit more. So I think the number one thing to me is the just the strength of these heavier personnel groupings and how the NFL turned to it. And then I won't dive into this one, but I think the use of pre-snap motion and the success that we saw out of the teams, the five teams that used the most pre-snap motion all made the postseason. Smart coaches with good offenses are using more pre-snap motion. I think the league, now that we're starting to see and measure these things that we weren't talking about / measuring efficiencies 5-6 years ago, now we have the data thanks to charting and player tracking. Now we can clearly lay out that pre-snap motion is beneficial. I think more teams are going to start using that in the future as well.
Yeah, we are having a resurgence of the fullback of the second tight end. You know, people, this a very under the radar personnel move that happened this offseason was Blake Bell, who played about 38% of the snaps for the Chiefs in the regular season and actually more than that in the postseason. He moved on. The team let him go in free agency, moved him to, and he signed with the Dallas Cowboys. But, you know, now the second tight end for the Chiefs is Ricky Seals-Jones. Maybe they play Deion Yelder a little bit more. I actually think the Chiefs could be a team that ends up playing a ton of 10 personnel in 2020. But yeah, I mean, that heavy personnel grouping, just when you are scheming things out from a schematic perspective and looking at things as a defensive coordinator, it's a lot harder to guard players who can do multiple things. So like when teams are in 10 personnel, when you use a lot of pre-snap motion and you're creative with the way you design runs, you can run, but it's a lot easier to run with a second elite blocker out there, right? Especially when that elite blocker can catch passes, you know, the ways we see with a lot of these teams, like the 49ers that you were just discussing. Juszczyk is a useful pass catcher, and their back end tight ends are useful pass catchers as well. But I think you make a very interesting point where going into the 2019 season, that was about the last thing we expected. You know, we thought that the air raid was coming to the NFL and that every team was going to be playing four wide receivers pretty much as their base set.
Yeah, and I think that there's definitely times that you would want to use those personnel groupings, and it starts first and foremost with what's the strength of your team. You know, is your fourth wide receiver and the fact that, like, you're going to be probably passing the ball and your quarterback doesn't have as much time for protection, is that fourth wide receiver most beneficial to be out on the field, or would you stand to benefit by having a tight end out there or a second tight end, right? And so you have to look at it from your personnel perspective and then the types of things that you can scheme up off of that. But the biggest thing that helps defenses is when an offense is predictable. And so you absolutely cannot give chips back. The rules are so slanted towards helping offenses that you can't be predictable with whatever personnel grouping that you have out on the field, which is why oftentimes when you have these slightly heavier sets, and then can be unpredictable out of them, that's going to benefit you. I think there's a couple of underrated fullback moves. You mentioned one of them. We also have Andy Janovich going from Denver over to Cleveland. I think that's going to be big with Kevin Stefanski coming from Minnesota. Minnesota, prior to Stefanski taking over, was down at 7%, 21 personnel. He moved up to 22%, 21 personnel. The biggest jump of any team in the league. Obviously, Minnesota made the postseason last year. He's bringing that mentality to Cleveland, and they brought Andy Janovich in. And then we also have a very underrated move, but Derek Watt coming from the Chargers, now the fullback for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he's a very dynamic player. And actually, if you read the Chargers chapter in my book, you'll see that, you know, when he was out on the field and he was playing 21 personnel, the offense was much better, significantly better than from the other grouping. So I was a little bit surprised. I know the Chargers don't use a lot of analytics, but I was a little bit surprised that they let him go. But I do think that that's definitely going to help benefit the Pittsburgh Steelers a little bit.
And they need it with hoping that Ben gets healthy. Would not surprise me to have them have more blocking style players on the field more often, because their entire season is going to rest on Ben not taking hits, Ben's elbow staying healthy. So kind of along those lines, what team are you highest on relative to the market, whether that be Super Bowl odds, win total, division odds? For me, it is the Arizona Cardinals. You know, if we're looking historically at players like Kyler Murray, Heisman Trophy winner, number one overall pick, played reasonably competent as a rookie. You know, he had some mistakes in terms of taking way too many sacks, though I think that as the season went on, he definitely improved in his decision-making and, you know, forcing him to play with Max Williams and Demir Byrd and Keyshawn Johnson, I don't think did him a ton of favors, which is part of why the organization, drafted or sent the second round pick for DeAndre Hopkins. And, I hope we get to see Andy Isabella this year. So for me, it's the Cardinals for sure. Though, you know, Cliff Kingsbury's decision-making definitely leaves a little bit to be desired, but who is it for you?
Well, I will note this about the Arizona Cardinals. Like, one of the good things that I actually saw from Kingsbury when I dug back into the numbers and walked away very impressed with was him coaching a little bit more towards what he had on the roster. And what I'll say there is, if you look back at their season, they wanted to start playing a lot of 10 personnel. They wanted to put a lot of these wide receivers out on the field. And he intentionally hid that from us in the preseason. I think he played 10 personnel, just two snaps the entire preseason, based on what I had looked at. So they were hiding it, and then they definitely trotted it out the first couple of games. But then they started having wide receivers go down, wide receivers get injured. And what he did is he shifted to a lot more 12 personnel, which is very different for an air raid coach, right, who's used to having zero tight ends out on the field and 10 personnel, there's zero tight ends. Now he's throwing a lot more 12 personnel. That's actually what helped them get the win in Cincinnati, their first win of the season after starting out 0-3-1 in their first 4 weeks. Then they followed that up with a win in Atlanta and a win against the Giants. A lot of their production efficiency came out of 12 personnel because he shifted to that with all the injuries to his wide receivers. Instead of saying next man up, we're going to play 10 personnel, I don't care, this is what I want to teach my quarterback, they were making decisions based upon the health of the roster. So it wasn't a perfect season for Kingsbury. Nor was it for Kyler Murray. And I definitely agree with you that, you know, second year quarterbacks tend to make a big jump, same scheme, same system, new skill players that are going to help improve things. Got rid of David Johnson. That's going to help improve the efficiency of the run game, to have a back in there that's a little bit more of what Kingsbury thinks will work for his offense. But I think like his creativity as a head coach, not to stick to his guns and to be a little bit more creative with what he wanted to utilize based upon the strength of those players, bodes well for future decision-making out of him. And so I hope that that's the case, because I don't disagree with your forecast that Arizona is poised to make a nice jump in year two with Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury together. For me, I'll go with the Cleveland Browns. I talked about them getting Andy Janovich in there before, but one of the biggest frustration points I think league-wide was looking at what Baker Mayfield did last season. He was in the very similar spot with Kyler Murray, right, where he's year two. He worked a little bit with his former head coach, Freddie Kitchens, the prior year. He gets a full season with Freddie Kitchens. We thought, hey, Freddie did some smart things down the stretch after Hugh Jackson got fired, and we think that that's going to play out into 2019, get a full season of Baker with Freddie, year two, quarterback jump. I wasn't on him, but a lot of people were on the Cleveland Browns last season thinking that this was going to be a really good team. And then what happened? They obviously sucked. They won only 6 games. they did not look very good. They were disjointed. They end up having that big brawl at the end of the season. Just shows kind of how the their season in a nutshell went. And this was a team that everybody sort of moved on from Baker Mayfield. Like, the hype he was getting heading into last season versus the hype he's getting right now, it's just completely night and day. Everybody's moved on past Baker Mayfield up. He's not going to be able to cut as an NFL quarterback. He was so terrible last season. But when I dug into what they were doing in 2019, I found they made far too many mistakes like they were making in 2018. And that was when the field is spread with 10 personnel or more so 11 personnel, Baker Mayfield really struggled pre-snap. He struggled with where he was perceiving pressure was going to come with fewer blockers on the field. It looked too much more like an obvious passing situation. And he gets rattled under pressure. He gets rattled from these personnel groupings. For whatever the reason, it's night and day difference what he does out of 11 personnel versus what he does when he's in heavier personnel groupings beforehand. And in comes Todd Monken, who is an air raid type coordinator, right? He comes from an air raid system, and he was trying to utilize a little bit more air raid. Now, I know that there's a lot of discussion that, you know, well, if we had used more Todd Monken, that would have been the answer. But I don't think people actually looked at the numbers before they said that, because the fact of the matter is weeks 1 through 9, 84% of the Browns passes came from 11 personnel. And that's a ridiculously high amount. That's one of the highest amounts in the entire NFL. 84% for the first 9 weeks comes from 11 personnel. That was not what Freddie Kitchens was doing in the last few games of the season when he was calling plays in 2018. This was something that Todd Monken's influence was having them use a lot more 11, and they were very bad. The times that they were using 12 personnel or even 13, that's when they were far better in 2019. So here's why I'm saying Cleveland is in a much better position this year. No Todd Monken, no Freddie Kitchens. Those guys couldn't cut it. We bring in Kevin Stefanski. He used the least amount of 11 personnel of any coach in the league last season in Minnesota. How do you use less 11? Well, you have to have fullbacks. You have to have tight ends. Well, they go out in the draft. They get a tight end from Florida Atlantic, Harrison Bryant. Then they go out and trade for Andy Janovich in free agency. They also sign, they sign Austin Hooper. Then they go out and they secure their tackle positions by drafting Jedrick Wills, number 10 overall out of Alabama. Boom, left tackle problem, hopefully solved long term. Let's fix the right tackle. We go out and get Jack Conklin. So now we've got both the tackles. So at the edges of the line are much better than what they were last year. We have a coach who's going to call more plays from heavier personnel, and we have the personnel to do that. And I just think you stick like Odell Beckham and Jarvis Landry out there with a couple tight ends, or you stick a couple backs out there on the field with those two wide receivers, and you're not going to find very many offenses that have two wide receivers as good as what they've got in Cleveland. Then they can give Baker the protection that he needs. Then you factor in that the schedule moves from the third toughest passing schedule in 2019 to the number one easiest schedule for Baker Mayfield this upcoming season of opposing pass defenses. I mean, all these things together, like you're taking an ingredient here, an ingredient there, an ingredient elsewhere, mixing them together, and that result is very friendly towards Baker Mayfield. And so as long as he doesn't blow it, as long as he doesn't completely explode, like overcook this thing, like we are going to have a really good 2020 Baker Mayfield. And it's going to look much different than what we've seen in prior years. And I think people are going to get caught a little bit by surprise, at least based on perceptions of what Baker is when they left 2019 to what we're going to see out of him in 2020.
Yeah, I'm very on board with this. I think Baker has a lot of the traits and skills that you look for in a successful quarterback in 2020. You know, like he's more mobile than the average quarterback. He's not afraid to make tight window throws. And, you know, it does make sense to me that he would do better in heavy personnel groupings with, you know, with that idea in mind that he's willing to force some of those tight window throws or give his guys, you know, give his guys a chance to win in single coverage, even if they don't generate the most amount of separation. Do you think that David Njoku ends up, you know, playing a meaningful amount of snaps for them? Because, you know, it does seem like their best personnel is either the 21 with Chubb and Hunt, or the 12 with Njoku, Hooper, Beckham, Landry, and then one of Chubb or Hunt. And, you know, obviously Njoku has, he's been kind of this roller coastery guy in his NFL career. But I think Njoku really does help unlock the ceiling for this Stefanski offense.
I agree 100%. I mean, Njoku's problem is just staying healthy and staying out on the field. And obviously he wants to get out of there for whatever reason. I'm not sure, because I think if he's healthy, he's going to have a lot of opportunity. I could see why, you know, he doesn't love the fact that they went and got Austin Hooper, but I don't think that means that we don't want to use him more often, unless they're like super sold on Harrison Bryant and they think Harrison Bryant's just a total stud who's going to come in and take snaps away from Njoku. But I think Njoku's upside, his talent, his athleticism is obviously off the charts, and we need to get this guy targeted a little bit more in the passing game. And I just think that there's so many edges that you get by sticking a couple tight ends out there on the field, especially guys as talented as these guys are. Because again, it's not, to me, it's not just about the personnel. It's then what the defense has to do to match up with that personnel. And when the defense is trying to find a guy who's going to match up with David Njoku, like, look, Jarvis Landry and Odell Beckham are absolute studs at what they do. They're very good at what they do. On occasion, you're going to find a really good cover corner or a good defense that's playing a scheme that's going to try to slow down some of these guys by, you know, manning them up with this guy or playing cloud coverage, doing something to slow those guys down. But how do you really slow down a couple of good receiving tight ends? It's very difficult to do that because they're going to get matched up in positive ways most of the time that they're out on the field. Like, it's very difficult. You might have one good tight end, one good linebacker who's good at covering a tight end, or one good safety. Like, you could stick Jamal Adams on one guy, but you are not going to be able to find another guy on your roster who's good enough to match up with Njoku if you're sticking your best coverage option on Austin Hooper. So, like, there's just no way that you're going to match up strongly enough against those guys. And then if the alternative is, well, if they did try to slow down my second tight end out on the field on this reception, guess what? Beckham is going to be in a pristine situation outside. It's just very difficult. So I really hope that Njoku stays in Cleveland, because I think that Cleveland is going to utilize him. And I hope he stays healthy, because he's going to have opportunities this year to produce.
Where do you stand on Odell Beckham? Actually, he's become a guy that people really like to argue about online, because, you know, it does happen where these guys who are insanely efficient early in their career, if they have, you know, multiple years of lower body injuries, it tends to lead to them falling off a cliff earlier. You know, we have the Hakeem Nicks example. Now, obviously, guys like Julio Jones, he's had as many lower body injuries as you can possibly name. About the only thing that Julio hasn't done is actually torn his ACL. But I tend to be more of a Beckham optimist, you know, still taking him in fantasy leagues, still thinking he is, you know, more than cut out to be a team's true number one offensive weapon. Do you have an opinion on Odell Beckham specifically?
I think that he probably, the hype a couple of years ago raised his ceiling too high, that he's not going to be able to meet those expectations. But if enough people are down on him at this point, then I think that there is room for optimism just with the offensive system that he's in. They don't have to rely on him to, and I know from a fantasy perspective, you want those targets, right? But they are not in a position that you're going to need to rely on him to do everything and be your complete savior. And as long as his head is screwed on right, so that he doesn't flip out when the offense is targeting some of these other guys, I think he's going to be in a great position to have opportunities this season. Like, to me, I'm a little bit different where how I approach things. I'm not, generally speaking, the type of guy that wants to rely on just one weapon out on the football field unless the rest of my offense is bad. Like, I don't look at it as, okay, well, I got these number one wide receivers, so I've got to just give them everything because they're my number one wide receiver. I will do that if my other options aren't good. But if my other options are fine, then I'm going to balance my offense as best as possible, because that's the hardest thing to defend. And in this case, I just think that there are a lot of weapons here in Cleveland, and they may be able to run the ball more efficiently as well. And then when they drop back to pass, those passes, there's a lot of different receiving targets out there. I think the targets that Beckham gets this season are going to be higher value targets some than what he's gotten in the past. I think he's got room for more upside per target this year than he's had in the past. Will he see the same level of volume? Well, I don't think so, because they were 6-10 last year and they've been a losing team for several years. And I think that they can actually have a winning season this upcoming year. Maybe won't be passing the ball quite as much in the fourth quarter, and maybe spreading the ball around a little bit more from a target perspective. But the other thing people need to realize, especially when I say more higher value targets, the way you're going to get higher value targets is by getting more targets in the red zone. And the way you're going to get more red zone targets is if you've got a good offense around you. The way you're going to have a good offense around you is if you've got a better coaching staff and a team that's able to move the football down the field to get you in those positions more often. So the fact that this offense is balanced and spread out and has good weapons elsewhere and hopefully calls strong enough plays is actually a positive for Beckham, because he's going to get more. The Browns are probably going to have more red zone snaps in 2020 than they had in 2019. And that's a very good thing for any skill position player that you might be drafting from fantasy. So I don't know if that gets to answer your question, but I think that there is still reason to be optimistic about him this upcoming season. Now, if the question doesn't relate to fantasy as much as it does just his overall health, it is tough. Like, anytime a guy gets older and is banged up, you know, those are things that you're going to have to work through a little bit more. And he certainly doesn't have the frame nor the build like a Julio Jones to more easily overcome some of those things. But hopefully I don't know what his season holds for his health, but obviously I wish nothing but the best from a health perspective. But I still think Odell Beckham has several good years ahead of him, several more useful years. I don't know that we're going to need him to be used as this stud number one, like he was needing to be used for a couple of years with the Giants.
Yeah, his role is different now. You know, he's kind of the field stretcher, whereas Landry is more of the, you know, third and seven guy. Like, they're going to be going towards Landry. Obviously, this team is going to run the ball a lot. They're going to target Kareem Hunt in the shorter areas of the field a lot, you know, as long as Hunt and Chubb are both healthy. Sticking to evaluating younger players, I'm wondering if you see any breakouts from these younger quarterbacks in terms of, you know, ascending into that next tier of player, you know, into maybe not the Mahomes, Lamar, Deshaun Watson level tier, but that kind of that next tier of like Kirk Cousins level guys, so that these would be guys like Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Kyler Murray, maybe even Justin Herbert, the Baker we already talked about. I think maybe even Gardner Minshew, though his decision-making and his overall arm strength probably make that more of a long shot. I think Darnold is the most interesting one to discuss because he's so young, and the samples we have of him seem flawed because he missed time due to mono, you know, wasn't getting a ton of practice. And also his coaching situation, you know, I think I feel comfortable saying Adam Gase is at best an average NFL coach and probably a below average NFL coach from the samples we have and, you know, what his players seem to say about him. Obviously my vote here would be for Kyler, but I actually do see the potential for Darnold to become that guy, but I don't know if it's going to happen on this Jets team.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. Let's start with Darnold, because I think the Adam Gase read that you have is dead on. Look, the Jets, over the first three quarters of their games last year, used 69% 11 personnel, which was 12% above the league average for the first three quarters of games. Yet they averaged negative 0.18 EPA per attempt. That was the second worst in the NFL. They had a 6.5 yards per attempt, 12-12 TD to interception ratio, took a sack on 10% of dropbacks. All those metrics are bottom five in the NFL, yet they stayed at 11 personnel at one of the highest rates of any team in the league. It's just a problem that Gase and Dowell Loggins have. They want to use 11 and they just stick with it. And it's the exact opposite of Cliff Kingsbury, where Kingsbury is trying to play to the strengths of his roster. These guys are just like, okay, well, this is what we do, so we're going to use it a lot. I don't like them as coaches. I don't like them as play callers. And so I absolutely have concerns with them, and I have concerns with this offense and who they're going to be trotting out there. You know, you still have Le'Veon Bell out there who still thinks he, you know, is like this best bell cow back in the league who deserves all the praise. And, you know, he 3.2 yards per carry last season after he sat out the 2018 season. You know, that certainly wasn't getting it done. I just think the play calling for Darnold, I think of all the guys who have unlocked potential and skill, but we haven't seen it yet, is Darnold of all the guys that you mentioned. I think Kyler has the higher 2020 ceiling of those guys that you mentioned. But one guy that I want to mention that you didn't, who I don't see him getting even like up to above league average, but maybe who we will see have a large jump compared to what we saw of him last year and will look a lot better, is Dwayne Haskins. I think Dwayne Haskins, look, last year, Jay Gruden came out and said, and this is all in the chapter on the Redskins, well, on the Washington football team in my book, but Jay Gruden came out and said, this guy's not ready to play. He's not ready to play the first few weeks of the season. Yet he kept him in as the second quarterback, making Colt McCoy inactive. And so inevitably, when you have an injury to your starter, you're going to have to throw the backup in there. And unfortunately, because they were making Colt McCoy inactive, when Case Keenum went down a couple of times, that meant Dwayne Haskins is getting thrown to the wolves. And that's exactly what happened in a couple games in the season before he was named full-time starter. He got thrown to the wolves, looked terrible, came out. You know, he wasn't getting first-team reps during the practice week heading into that. He wasn't getting first-team reps in camp. Jay Gruden is trying to maintain his job. He's trying to keep his job. He's trying to get Case Keenum ready to be his starter to hopefully produce a winning record so that he can stay employed. He's not trying to develop a quarterback who was just drafted in Dwayne Haskins. He wants to keep his job. And all of a sudden, he has to throw this guy in there without the reps. He looked bad. It was really bad for Haskins' mentality, his psyche. And we saw a little bit of improvement over the last few games of the season when he was the full-time start. But I think he's going to show a lot more improvement this year. Number one, far easier schedule. They played the 13th toughest pass defenses in 2019. They play the 6th easiest schedule of pass defenses in 2020. That's number one. Number two, I think Scott Turner far better than what they had last year calling plays for Dwayne Haskins. We saw Dwayne Haskins, right? He's under a lame duck coach. They fired Jay Gruden. All of a sudden, you got these coaches who are lame ducks in there calling plays, not the standard play caller. Here you get Scott Turner calling plays from day one, working with Haskins from day one. Absolutely not the most ideal situation. Many of the players that you mentioned and listed out, apart from Herbert, had the same offensive coordinator from last year, had the same system, more experience with that. That's not going to be the case for Haskins. So in a season of change, that's not a great position to be in. And we may not see the best of him over the first month of the year, but once he gets into it more and more adept with this offense, I think we will. The key takeaway for Scott Turner is what we saw in 2018 with Cam Newton. I personally believe that Cam would not mesh well with what the Turners, Norv, who was the OC at the time, and Scott, who was his quarterback's coach, were going to try to get Cam to do. But they got Cam to do something that we hadn't seen before. We got a much different 2018 version of Cam Newton, and he was very efficient when he was out there on the field doing a lot of things that we weren't accustomed to seeing him do and doing those really well. That shows me that Scott will be able to adapt some of the things that he wants to call to make Dwayne look really good. I think he's a player-friendly coordinator. He's a quarterback-friendly coordinator who's going to call plays that are easier for his quarterback to handle and make his quarterback look good. And that's going to be important with the skill position talent that they have out there and the offensive line that they have in front of them. But I'm also a little bit excited about some of the young guys on the offensive side of the ball that they've got in there. If they can integrate Gibson in a little bit more of the course of the season and Antonio Gandy-Golden in, I think he's got a lot of potential and talent. So I'm just excited in general about the growth that we'll see from this Redskins from this Washington football team's offense from last year to this. Of course, I didn't mention the guy everybody's in love with, Terry McLaurin. I certainly think that he's going to have a strong season as well, and he's going to benefit from the change to Scott Turner, as well as more practice and experience for Dwayne Haskins, things that he lacked last season.
Well, Haskins is really interesting because his college coaches absolutely swear by him, right? Like they, like Urban Meyer was like, this guy is incredible. You know, the most accurate guy I've ever coached. He was incredible in his final season at Ohio State, you know, over 10 yards per adjusted attempt, 50 touchdowns to 8 interceptions. And unlike a lot of, you know, unlike a lot of other Ohio State quarterbacks that and Urban Meyer quarterbacks that we've seen have success, you know, he was not a running quarterback, right? So, you know, unlike Tebow, unlike JT Barrett, unlike Alex Smith, he was doing it pretty much all with his arm. And I mean, I think that if there was one guy who went from being, you know, pretty much an afterthought when discussing young quarterbacks, I totally agree with you. Like, would it surprise me if we get a 4,200-yard 35 touchdown season out of Haskins, you know, in the next couple years? No, because I totally agree with you that he has the arm talent to do it. They're also setting him up well with weapons. Now, they don't really have any usable tight ends on the roster, though I've been a long-term Logan Thomas truther at the position, but McLaurin and Sims are pretty strong. Trey Quinn as the slot guy. It wouldn't surprise me if they spend another wide receiver pick in the 2021 draft. I think that Haskins is a pretty good under-the-radar candidate there.
And the one thing I'll just add is that Scott Turner understands that the way to help a young quarterback is not to run on early downs and just hope that you can get to third and manageable and then you pass it. He understands that. So we're going to see an increased first down pass rate, in my opinion, with Dwayne Haskins this season. And we also are in a very different situation than he was in with his quarterbacks last year with regard to Carolina. In Carolina, right, they had Christian McCaffrey, like a stud running back. They don't have that this year on this roster. You look across the board, they've got a lot of options. There's a lot of, like, guys in that Redskins running back room, sorry, Washington football team running back room that look okay, right? Like, okay, I remember this guy. Like, he's had some good years or some good runs in his career. Like, there's some guys and veterans there, but there's nobody that you'd be like, man, I really think we can give 300 carries to this guy. I think this guy is going to be our guy. So I think Scott is going to manage these running backs and change the running back room around. Certain guys are going to play more this week than the other week. It's going to be a fluid situation from a running back perspective, but the more emphasis is probably going to be on the passing attack of this team. I don't think we're going to have this strong run heavy offense. And actually I write about this in the book too. And I'm just remembering back to it now as we're discussing this, Davis, that Carolina was actually one of the most efficient teams throwing the ball on early downs last year. Where things fell apart was on third downs, and where things fell up obviously with Kyle Allen, and where things fell apart was like in second halves of games. But Kyle Allen was actually very productive. He knew where to go with the football. He threw just one interception on first down all season long. He's not a good quarterback, but they had good play calls, and he was well coached to know where to go with the football. And I'm reading directly out of my book here. He recorded 8.2 yards per attempt on first down, which ranked eighth best in the NFL, slotting in right behind Patrick Mahomes at 8.5 yards per attempt. And his other first down passing metrics, such as EPA, success rate, passer rating, all ranked above the league average. He was also very good on early downs without even using play action, which is something that some quarterbacks need more so as a crutch, and they're terrible without it. He was actually fine without play action on these early down passes. So those things bode well for early down pass rate. And the other thing too, even with Kyle Allen, the Carolina Panthers passed the ball on first downs last year 54% of the time. The league average is only 48% of the time. So you're already talking about 6% above the league average with a guy like Kyle Allen, who's total backup, and with a running back like Christian McCaffrey. So I think without Christian McCaffrey, with a better quarterback talent in Dwayne Haskins, that you could have even a higher pass rate for the Washington football team this upcoming season. And I absolutely agree with all the other points that you made there on Haskins.
Yeah, I think that his development and Darnold's development, and all these young quarterbacks, really, it's the most important storyline in the NFL right now, because we are about to see Philip Rivers retire. We're about to see Drew Brees retire. We're probably close to the end of Cam Newton. We're probably close to the end of Tom Brady, though. I don't know if I want to publicly go against Brady, you know, trying to play until he's 50 or whatever. But, you know, theoretically, not an impasse, but just at a historical turning point with a lot of the great quarterbacks of the last 10 to 15 years in their last few years in the league. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on these younger quarterbacks, you know, these first round guys. The last thing I wanted to cover with you is futures bets. You know, people love to sweat the futures. I have a couple that I've been holding, you know, that the numbers are not near as good. When futures were first launched back in February, you could get Kyler Murray to win the MVP at 44-1 on the FanDuel Sportsbook. I believe he's pretty much down at like 12 or 15-1 everywhere now. But in terms of how you are allocating futures dollars, are there a few that you still think are plus EV out there?
Yeah, there are. I mean, look, I think we haven't, this is a very different off season. We can't talk about futures like we talk about any other season, because a lot of the bigger money that will come in on futures tends to come when the limits are higher. Also,
yeah, it's not there yet.
It's not there yet, number one. And number two, it's being held out a little bit because of this uncertainty. Like, nobody wants to put up, you know, five figures, six figures. Well, you'd have to do a lot of work to get down six figures, I guess. But even five figures on some of these futures running around from book to book, because most have like $5,000 limits, and try to lock up your money if you don't think that we're going to play into December, and then all the money that you spent and work that you did on these futures is going to be for naught, right? So, but there are, I think, some opportunities. Number one, I think people should understand, it depends. You got to really pay attention to what the books say, but you may have a shortened season, but you're still going to have like division winners, and so there may be some bets that would still stand even if some of the season win totals aren't right. To have the season win totals, you got to play 17 game season because it's based upon that, but you might still get a team to win the AFC North. And they only played 14 games and had to shut down the season or something like that. I mean, this is like pessimist in me talking, but that's still a possibility. Now, I think that there's still some upside in, like, I'm big on the Cleveland Browns. I'll just give a couple. I'm big on the Cleveland Browns, whether you want to take them to make the playoffs plus 125, you know, plus money, or you want to take them over their win total. 8.5, I think, is minus 125. You can also take an alt line at winning 10 games, right? Winning over 9.5 games at like plus 160. I think one thing people need to realize as it relates to teams and quarterbacks and offenses, et cetera, two things. Number one, offense and quarterback are linked to their play caller. And so when you get a new play caller in there who knows what they're doing and calling smarter plays, this offense has the potential to look a lot different. And number two, it actually doesn't relate to offense, but relates to defense. Like, both sides of the ball factor off of one another. So this defense is going to look a lot better if the offense looks better too, right? So those things come together. They're in a very difficult division. I would not be betting them to win their division, but I think to just make the playoffs is a bet that they could probably hit. And over 8.5 wins, I think, is a bet that looks interesting. I think I'm down on the Texans, but having them at a 7.5 win total is pretty low to me. So I think that 7.5 wins is just far too low. There's a couple. I mean, I like I was looking a lot at the Detroit Lions. I think the Detroit Lions are going to be a better team than a lot of people expect them to be this season. If you look at what they were doing when Matthew Stafford was healthy, I think he makes just a colossal difference, and this team can win some games. The problem is they really didn't do a lot this offseason to make themselves that much better. Now, I will say, if you look across their division, apart from the Chicago Bears getting in Nick Foles, who hopefully will be better, obviously the Mitchell Trubisky was, I don't think the Minnesota Vikings improved all that much. They drafted a ton of guys, but that's going to take some time to work those guys in. Losing Diggs and losing your coaching staff, doesn't necessarily make you a better team. They might not be that much worse, but they haven't gotten that much better. And the Green Bay Packers didn't really do anything, especially offensively, to help themselves get better. And I definitely think we're going to get a lot of regression from them. This is not a 13-3 team. This team actually, compared to the 6-10 team that they were in 2018, their 2019 offense was worse from a efficiency perspective on early downs, from an ability to bypass third down, and from an average yards to go on third down. Their 2018 team that got Mike McCarthy fired was actually better than everything that they were doing in 2019. The reason that they were so good in 2019 was because they were in better positions from a leads perspective on the board, that they could be a little bit more balanced. They had a good running attack, but more so the reason they were in those positions to be able to run the ball more was thanks to their defense facing a ridiculously terrible schedule of opposing quarterbacks, whether it was guys who aren't going to be starters this year, whether it was guys that were rookies last year. Their defense, if you look through it, I listed it out in my chapter on the Packers, which is terrible. And so I think that they're going to be in a more difficult position and didn't really do a lot to upgrade their roster this offseason. So from that perspective, you know, I think that the Lions, the fact that they didn't do anything massive, in my opinion, really doesn't put them that far behind the eight ball. And if they get health out of Stafford, this is a team that absolutely nobody's talking about that could actually impress.
I like that one. I mean, if you look at the eight games that Matt Stafford played last year, I remember on this podcast, we were talking about NFL awards last year, and Matt Stafford, before he got injured, was number 5 on my MVP ballot because that's how good he was playing. And, you know, I do think that it seems like the team now is playing a more optimal style of football that's better for Matt Stafford's skill set. And I actually think they were kind of forced into that by the Kerryon Johnson injury. You know, they were playing better formations. They were throwing the ball in more efficient ways. The last future I want to throw out to get your opinion on is, depending on the book, you can get Dallas to win the Super Bowl anywhere between 18-22-1. I think that's good for a couple reasons. One, I do kind of buy this Mike McCarthy like analytics Buddhism tour that he went on, where he like got to the soul of what makes football work. I think them keeping Kellen Moore on as the play caller is a super bullish signal that the organization realizes the way they played on offense last year was very optimal, and where they lacked was on defense and in decision making in close games. They also just kind of got unlucky in close games overall as well. And the NFC to me is just a much weaker division in terms of not having clear to the two best teams in the NFL. They're both in the AFC. I think that, you know, the Buccaneers, the Rams, the Seahawks, the 49ers, I think all these teams have paths to being worse than they were last season. I think the Cowboys have a clear path to being, you know, the best offense in football.
Look, I think that's a sneaky, smart wager. Not that I'm saying that I think it's extremely likely, but at that price, I think it's really smart. Look, there are a lot of things going for the Cowboys. Number one, you're looking at teams still working on rebuilding in their own division. So the first step to winning the Super Bowl is obviously, how can I make the playoffs? And so we think that they've got a good shot at making the playoffs this year. I'm guessing that two teams from the NFC East are going to make the postseason. So having that extra seventh team definitely benefits the NFC East in particular, with having one of those ability to fill that seventh spot in the playoffs. They went 1-6 in one score games last year, and they still won 8 games. This is a team that, I agree with you, has a really good shot at seeing some of the things that they do improved with Mike McCarthy's influence. One of the things that's frustrated the hell of me, I don't know if it's bothered you too, Davis, but I just can't stand how they utilize Ezekiel Elliott in the passing game.
Oh, it's so brutal. Yeah, it's the most brutal thing about the team.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, if you're going to throw a pass, like, this guy obviously is talent. He's good in the open field. How are you throwing him the ball in such the worst times to throw him the ball that these running back passes have just such negative value and are so terrible? There's no reason why the Cowboys should be as bad as they are throwing to running backs. One of the things that Mike McCarthy always did well up in Green Bay was getting passes to running backs. So I think that they're going to, if they can increase their ability to utilize the running back, and then I think they get a big plus by just simply not having Jason Witten on the roster, right? Like the fact that they aren't going to be throwing targets to Jason Witten instantly improves their ceiling for 2020. So I like Blake Jarwin. I think getting rid of Witten, and even if they had to go 10 personnel a little bit more, they've got more receivers out there than a lot of teams in the league. I think that they have the ability to stay very balanced offensively. I think they've got a manageable schedule. I do like Dak. Some people don't. I like Dak. I think if they let Dak run the ball a little bit more, be smarter in the red zone. That's the biggest key to me if they want to reach their upside. The Cowboys have been terrible in efficiency down inside of the red zone, particularly with regard to when they hand the ball to Ezekiel Elliott. His efficiency in the red zone has been absolutely absurdly terrible. He recorded a 39% success rate in 2020 when he was running the ball inside of, I believe it was the 10-yard line. Over the last 2 years, inside of the 10-yard line, he has a 39% success rate. Dak Prescott, when he runs the ball, 64% success rate. So stop, just make your play calling down inside the 10-yard line a little bit more efficient. Stop making Ezekiel Elliott run the ball in predictable rushing situations. Allow Dak to run the ball a little bit more often. Spread the field more. That's when you can run Zeke down there. Let Dak throw the ball a little bit more and or run it himself. I think there's a lot of things that they could do to improve their upside in the red zone, and that's probably what it's going to take ultimately to be able to win the Super Bowl. They were only 16th in the league last year in red zone conversion rate. Well, they were top five, top one, top two, and a lot of other metrics. So improve that a little bit. Stop throwing Zeke the ball in terrible situations. Use a little bit more of Mike McCarthy's intelligence. This offense can carry the team pretty far. They are probably going to be in games where they will have to outscore the other team. But, I mean, look at what Kansas City was doing last season. I think in his career, in order to beat Patrick Mahomes, when he's healthy, mind you, but when he's healthy, in order to beat him, opposing quarterbacks have averaged 39 points. That's what you have to put up to beat Patrick Mahomes when he's healthy. Now, I'm not suggesting Dallas and Dak are going to be that type of offense, but the fact is, if you have to force other teams to score into the 30s just to beat you, it's not easy for so many quarterbacks and offensive coordinators in the league to just put up 30 points like that. So I think that they've got a lot of potential. And once you're in that tournament, we've seen how so many different things have the opportunity to happen. And then you also have the benefit, right, of being able to hedge and being able to bring a little bit return of investment back while still having a pretty high upside with long shot odds like that.
Well, and what team benefits more than the Dallas Cowboys from an injury? I mean, if Ezekiel Elliott has to miss a bunch of times, so not only do they take out some of the most inefficient plays they run, but the coaching staff is not tempted to give him the ball 25 times a game, right? When Tony Pollard is in there, or even Jordan Chun, right, or Rico Dowdle, their third and fourth string guys, they would pretty much just be throwing the ball to their wildly efficient wide receivers, you know, of which they added CeeDee Lamb to, Michael Gallup and Amari Cooper, both who averaged over 9 yards a target last season. Like, yeah, like the thesis behind the Cowboys is essentially that they throw the ball like 65% of the time and are close to as efficient as they were last year and are able to kind of do a NFC representation of what the Chiefs do on offense.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree. And looking at some of the things that Dak was able to do last year on third down are very impressive, right? Like his completion percentage by depth of target, even on third down, is better than what the league average was. And so we're rooting for early down efficiency, but having a guy who can create out of structure on third down is very important to, I mean, this is Patrick Mahomes, right? This is the definition of Patrick Mahomes, is being able to make magic happen when the team needs it most. And so that's a great quality that Dak brings to the table as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining the show. Tell people about the book, where the book, and about sharpfootball.com.
Yeah, so the book, you can get it. Actually, it's at sharpfootballanalysis.com, but you can get the book up there. It's the 2020 football preview. It's 360 pages. I've been working on this thing for 3.5 months. It's up there in full color. And I think there's a lot to gain from reading it, whether it's from just a better understanding of football, but also from a fantasy perspective. We had Rich Rebar write up a lot of the fantasy information in there and provide in other areas as well. And we also had Dan Pizzuta write up a lot about these teams' defenses and what to expect from them. So it's a lot of good information up there. I think everybody's going to learn something from it, and head over to sharpfootballanalysis.com and check it out.
There we go. Warren, thank you very much for joining the show. Of course, everyone, go to sharpfootballanalysis.com. Read the book. It's great. It's, you know, when the book comes out, that's when football season starts for many of us. And we'll be back soon.